You're listening to the Fertility Docs Uncensored podcast, featuring insight on all things fertility from some of the top-rated doctors around America. Whether you're struggling to conceive or just planning for your future family, we're here to guide you every step of the way.
This podcast is sponsored by Receptiva DX. Receptiva DX is a powerful test that can help detect inflammatory conditions on the uterine lining that might be preventing you from becoming pregnant or staying pregnant. If you've experienced implantation failure or multiple miscarriages, ask your doctor about Receptiva DX. Uterine inflammation, if found, can be treated, providing a new pathway to achieving a successful pregnancy. Receptiva DX, because the journey's worth it.
Hello, everyone. This is Dr. Carrie Bedian from the Fertility Center of Las Vegas, back with another episode of Fertility Docs Uncensored. I am joined by my delightful and deliriously delectable darling co-hosts, Dr. Susan Hudson from Texas Fertility Center.
Hello, I love being delectable.
And Dr. Abby Eblin from Nashville Fertility Center.
I ate so much chocolate, I think I probably am delectable.
I think that is a very reasonable plan, especially because, you know, the more chocolate, the better. It's good for your
soul. That's right. I think it comes from my pores.
So I was reading something in, I don't even know where I came across, if it was newspaper or random, you know, news feed that came across my my attention. And it was talking about a gift that you could give to the San Antonio Zoo, close to where you are, Susan.
It is. I grew up going to the San Antonio Zoo.
So did you know about this particular program that I am referring to?
I was not aware that this was available to the residents of Central Texas. And I guess anyone who wanted to name their favorite insect.
And so do tell, Gary. Tell us what you're talking about.
So this program is you can pay them about $10 and they will name a cockroach after a person. They suggest X significant others.
Okay,
and
yeah.
And they will feed said cockroach to the animals as part of their dinner.
Ew.
That sounds really interesting. I bet it'd be interesting to know how much money they've made from that. I bet that's a big hit in a lot of circles.
It is an interesting fundraising scheme. Let's put it that way.
I'm like, that is a really creative marketer that came up with that. That's awesome.
Instead, they've had people from dozens and dozens of countries around the world.
Wow.
To be fed to other animals. And they said that if you pay, I think it's like $10 per cockroach. But if you pay maybe $150, I think is what the article said, that they will send you a video of your cockroach being devoured.
I can't think of anything worse than having a video of that
being eaten.
Ugh.
Yeah. It's the cleverest thing that I can think of, because you're donating to a good cause. You are releasing yourself of bad karma. And
you might be passing on bad karma though.
Yeah, that's true. You know, on the flip side, and this is completely different, and I don't want to offend anybody or make this a similar analogy, but my very best friends are both Catholic, and they're there for a few years ago, and they may still do it, that you can basically send a donation to the Catholic Church, and I forgot where it is, but you have a nun pray for a specific thing for you, and they'll pray for like a certain amount of time, like every night for you. So much more positive way to spend your money.
That is a little more positive, like, spin on...
Yeah, yeah.
Where you put your energy.
I don't know. Like, if you ask them, you know, please pray for me to be the unequivocal success in XYZ, that's essentially saying, let me trounce my enemies. Bum, bum, bum.
It's all perspective. Glass half full, glass half empty. I like the half full.
Yeah.
I'd love to know how many people have purchased cockroaches. Like, did it say in the article like how long it's been going on, or is it a new thing? Or
I don't think it's super new, but 8,000 people is the number that sticks in my brain, because I remember doing the math and going like, that's a pretty decent fundraiser for something you can do anyway.
Yeah,
that's incredible. You're going to feed them anyway.
Yeah, but that also brings up the issue of, in order to feed all these animals, someone somewhere has a cockroach farm.
Well, I was just going to ask the question. When I was in Florida in residency.
Well, I imagine it's pretty easy to get cockroaches to proliferate.
I was going to say, in Florida, we had these gigantic cockroaches that they called palmetto bugs, which sounds really nice. But they were, they were huge. You couldn't even stomp them with your shoe. And so I bet you in Texas, don't you guys have those same kind of big giant cockroaches?
So they're more in the coastal areas.
Oh, okay.
I have an aunt who's got a great story about what she calls a cruncher motel because she, like many years ago, they were at like a little motel and she heard something crunching and she went to go see what it was. And it was a roach eating a styrofoam cup. And so whenever there's somewhere that like we don't want to go because it may be maybe a little icky, you know, we're like, ooh, it might be a cruncher.
Yeah.
Ew, that's so gross.
Nasty.
All right. Well, on that deeply uplifting note, that I kind of feel like I brought that on. So
you did. You sent the text around to tell us about it. So it's your fault. Yeah,
I mean, that is karma on myself to think about roaches eating styrofoam cups. Ew. Susan, what questions do we have today that have nothing to do with insects?
All right. Nothing to do with insects. Okay. Here's our first one. I'm 37 and froze my eggs a year ago. During the process, I discovered I have PCOS. I suspected this because I had troublesome hair, but my OB/GYN initially dismissed my concerns because I had regular periods. I got 55 eggs over two retrievals, 36 from the first retrieval and 19 in the second. I got a new OB/GYN and did tons of blood work, insulin, glucose, FSH, testosterone, androstenedione, etc. And the only elevated level was my AMH, 7.66. I am active in an egg freezing Facebook group and see lots of women that post that a higher quantity of eggs means lower quality. I can't find any scientific information to substantiate that, but I was wondering, what are your thoughts?
You know, I think you can't really generalize. I think for a lot of people, they're really shocked though when they get a bunch of eggs. And of course, those were from two different, well, I guess 37 total, is that right? Or 55 total?
55 total, 36 and 19.
So as a general rule, I would say if you get 37 eggs, you're not going to have 37 embryos from those. And as Carrie said many times, it's a funnel effect. Not every egg fertilizes, not every egg develops. So I have had patients that have had that big number and only end up with one or two genetically normal embryos at the end. I will tell you though, I had a patient this week who had about that same number. She has 15 normal embryos. So you just don't know. I mean, it takes two to tango, you know, it's a team sport. And so we don't know what the sperm is going to do when it goes into the egg. And we just don't know how your egg's going to develop. So, but I think you're sitting pretty right now. I think most people would be thrilled to have 55 eggs that are frozen. Can't imagine that you wouldn't be able to get pregnant with 2, 3, maybe even more kids from all that. So I still think you're doing great and I wouldn't worry too much about it.
I would comment that, you know, I think there's a little truth on both sides, just like Abby said, in that, you know, we look at people who stimulate as egg donors and realistically, most egg donors are going to be giving out numbers like that. And we don't see problems in success rate. Okay. I think there is probably a personal balance that if you get over, you know, just at, like everything, when you're at the extreme, there can be problems. But I think also some of this kind of feeling of getting too many eggs actually probably had more to do with how we used to do IVF when we did fresh embryo transfers.
Yep.
Because what would happen is you would have these really high hormone levels, including progesterone, okay, towards the end of your stimulation, and your lining would start turning into a place where your lining wasn't going to be receptive. And so that fresh embryo transfer with a huge stimulation probably did have less chances of success now that we know how all of this works together. And so I'm thinking a lot of that is carryover from those days.
Mm-hmm. I would agree with that as well. I mean, I had a patient probably three years or so ago who she was very similar to you. I mean, she was about 36 years old. We got a huge number of eggs and we were fertilizing with donor sperm because her husband didn't have any. And she remains my personal record of 27 good quality embryos
Wow.
out of that retrieval. And And similarly, in that same time frame, I had somebody else who went through where we got a very similar number of eggs whose husband had really awful sperm. And we ended up with two embryos. Now, one of those kids has made a baby, and the next one we're going to transfer in about 2 weeks. So we'll see.
Woo!
But a lot of those numbers are highly dependent on things that aren't necessarily in your control right now. And like Susan said, there's a lot of stuff that is being talked about in IVF that is a holdover from 20 years ago when the technology was different. And now, now we're doing something that works a little bit better. And as a result, the higher egg numbers don't really make as much of a difference.
Mm-hmm.
So, okay.
Let's do one more.
Yeah.
Okay. I am 23 and was diagnosed with PCOS. My husband and I did 5 months of letrozole and two IUIs, just completed IVF in June. I got 51 eggs, 36 mature, 16 fertilized, and 11 became blasts. We did not get them genetically tested because I have age on my side. All of my pre-testing prior to transfer came back normal. We transferred our first embryo and thankfully we found out it took, but the HCG was only 57. I was concerned it was as high as what I have wanted. This test was completed on a Thursday and the next blood draw is the following Monday. The Monday blood draw was 201. My doctor advised me that it hadn't tripled as they would have liked it to. Another blood test to follow, but should I be concerned that things aren't doubling?
So that to me actually sounds like it did double. So Thursday it was 57.
Right.
And then you figure somewhere around Saturday, you would have expected it to be somewhere around 100 to 120.
But their doctor said it needed to triple. That's not really.
Well, it might have been over three. Was it 3 days? Because a lot of times we'll check patients on Friday and then Monday, and we say it needs to triple by Monday.
It was Thursday to Monday. So Thursday, well, Friday, Saturday, Saturday, Sunday, Monday.
Double twice.
It needs to double twice, which is different than tripling.
Right.
Because tripling means that you would expect it to be 150. Doubling twice means you expect it to be somewhere between 200 and 300.
Right. But we should also mention that doubling is something that we say to make life easy, that the data actually suggests that you need to have a minimal HCG rise of around 60 something.
It can be lower, but
it's minimum.
But we all feel better though when it at least doubles, if not better. But you're right. Yes. It doesn't necessarily mean it's a bad pregnancy. It's kind of one of those things you just have to wait it out.
It just means we need to watch it. At some point, it will start escalating because it has to get things in the right range.
Yeah.
So
unfortunately, there's a time frame where you just have to wait it out and keep seeing if it doubles. And then usually about a couple of weeks later, we're able to do an ultrasound and look and see if development's taking place the way it should.
Yeah.
I almost wonder, this can't be one of my patients because the timeline doesn't fit up. Because I remember, I have someone who I just released back to their OB. She just graduated from us, who had a very similar story. She did IVF. She had a transfer. Her first HCG at day 10 that we checked was low. And so I gave her the whole I'm worried talk. And then she had the nerve to go on and have a perfectly normal pregnancy.
And Which is fantastic.
But I mean, really, how dare you not do exactly what I say? Fortunately, she did it in the right direction. So we're all good. But that happens. And that's part of the reason why we don't ever give up on a pregnancy early. Like, we're going to hold it out until we're pretty darn certain this is not going to be normal before we take more definitive action.
Yeah, absolutely.
And remember, your safety is always our number one priority.
That's right.
True story. All right. So today the topic that we're going to talk about is a branch off of PGT testing, so pre-implantation genetic testing. And it's one that we don't often talk about. And this is talking about a false sense of security that people get with the genetic testing that we do. And I think all of us have seen this in one form or other. But what have you guys seen that makes this a topic that we really probably ought to talk about?
Well, I think we need to talk about what PGT can tell us and what PGT can't tell us.
And let's back up and say, what is PGT, in case somebody's never listened to our show before? What is PGT?
So PGT is pre-implantation genetic testing. And this is testing that we do by taking a biopsy of a blastocyst, so a day 5, day 6 embryo. We're typically taking, 4, 5, 6 cells from the trophectoderm, which is the outer layer of the embryo, what will eventually become the placenta.
And we send those couple of cells off to a specialty lab that identifies if there are 46 chromosomes in that embryo, or if there's more or less than that. And so the thought process behind it is that we're looking at whether or not this embryo has the genetic building blocks, at least in a large sense, to make it and to become a healthy live birth. Now, it's not a guarantee of that, though. And so why isn't it a guarantee that if you've got this pretty looking embryo that's got the right number of chromosomes, why is that not a guarantee for, first of all, a pregnancy?
So I think the first part to discuss here is that the one thing that we think of a lot is that there's a difference between chromosomes and genes. Okay, so genes code for specific kind of disease states. So something like cystic fibrosis. Okay, so oftentimes you can either have recessive or dominant genes. Most of the ones that we're going to talk about are recessive, which means you need to have one copy from mom and one copy from dad. And so you have to have these two copies to end up having a child with a abnormality. Okay. So when we test with PGT and we say there's the right number of chromosomes, I always think of the chromosomes being your hands and the genes being your fingers. Okay. I'm saying when you have the right number of chromosomes, you have two hands. I don't know how many fingers you got. Okay. And and so that's really
two hands,
no fingers.
No fingers.
Okay. And it's possible. It's possible. And so this is one reason why we encourage patients to do carrier screening. Okay. And carrier screening is usually done early in your fertility journey, or at least with your reproductive endocrinologist, where you either have blood or saliva, and we look for things that hide in the family tree until the right person meets the right person. If one person is a carrier, we generally test the other partner. If you're using donor eggs or donor sperm, we want to make sure those donors have been tested for anything you might be carriers for so that there's not a match. Even if there's not a match, there's very, very, very small, usually less than 1% chance of having a child with some of these conditions, okay? Because nothing is ever impossible. Genetics, there's some weird things that can happen, okay? But we're not going to get lost in the woods of that. But weird things can happen, but they're very, very unusual. But we want to make sure there's not a match. If you don't do testing, either because you're not aware testing's there, or if you decline testing, that means those things are possible. They are rare, but when it happens to you, it's 100%. So that's one reason.
But we've all seen that happen, yes. Right? I mean, we've even had patients that have come to our practice and we found out they had no idea that they carry these really unusual traits, and they would have never known about it if they hadn't been tested with a single gene test.
Right. And realize even with a single gene test, our new ones have, 500 to 600 tests. There's still things out there that are rare, but again, it's until the right person meets the right person. I know I kind of feel like I'm on a soapbox a little bit, but this is something I feel pretty passionate about.
Keep on going, Susan. You're doing great. Just keep on going.
A lot of times people come in, they're like, oh, I don't have any family history of anything. Okay.
Yes.
So my first thing to remember is that, if most of our patients are somewhere between 20 to 40, okay, their grandparents or great grandparents were in the generations that childhood and infant death was very common. Okay. And we all have grandmas and grandpas who had a sibling who didn't survive, past infancy or when they were 2 years old or they were, that child was always sick, that type of thing. And these things could have happened and we just don't know about it because we lived in a different society. We lived in a different world.
I would say that with 23andMe and Ancestry.com, one of the favors that they gave us was their commercials illustrate so well how we're all mutts. Like somebody on one commercial thought they had German ancestry. And then once they did their genetic testing, it's like, lo and behold, no, they were Italian. And so, there's no way that you would know if you carry an abnormal trait. I mean, you feel normal. Your healthy people can carry terrible traits. Like Susan said, it's only if you meet somebody else that carries that abnormal trait that you could have, one in four chance of having a child that's impacted by it.
Mm-hmm.
So sometimes people will say, well, why don't you just do all that testing on every embryo?
That is logistically and scientifically way too complicated. And honestly, you're almost getting into ethics that I don't think any of us would, you know, there's a difference between looking for carrier screening versus screening for the perfect.
Well, just logistically though, even if you said, okay, we're going to try and screen your embryo for 300 different traits. We all know, you know, if you have cystic fibrosis, you may have it because you have a piece of the gene deleted or something added to the gene or a point mutation. So everybody's mutation or a lot of people's mutations with cystic fibrosis are different. And so the only way you can really determine if the embryo has an issue is to develop a specific probe. So for some of the really specific, really unusual traits, not including like something like cystic fibrosis, but for really specific traits, a lot of times a probe has to actually be developed that's unique to you and unique to your partner. So we can really be certain that we're testing the embryo. And that's just for one gene. That's not for the 300 or 400 now that the tests have available. So logistically, you just couldn't do
and
that.
It, even it takes if you wanted to. 4 to 8 weeks to develop a probe for one gene abnormality that we're looking for.
So let's say someone decides to do their carrier screening. They're like, I want to do all the testing. So they do their carrier screening and they find out that they and their partner are both negative for all of the autosomal recessive genes that are being checked for. What is still not being checked for gene-wise in those carrier screens?
So autosomal dominant genes that are things that don't develop until adulthood. So probably the most classic one in our world that I think of is Huntington's. And so Huntington's is a disease that causes muscular neurological abnormalities and can eventually lead to psychosis and things like this. And so
it will.
And
that's 100% there.
And so these carrier things aren't going to detect that, but most people, if they are at risk of Huntington's, they know this because they've had parents or other family members who have been affected. And so those people can choose to be tested for the genes and potentially have their embryos tested.
Well, and just two, there's a lot of genes that probably have not been found that are pathologic. I have two couples right now who one partner had a pathologic gene for something that was recognized, and it wasn't until they had a baby that they realized that the other partner had a pathologic gene. So, you know, science continues on, and I know that we're going to find out more things as time goes by, but for single gene abnormalities, this is going to continue to evolve. And I think in science, as I tell my patients about everything, you can never say that something's 100% perfect in science and medicine. It just isn't. So I think that's one of the things that could go wrong with a pregnancy. When we talk about PGT-A, though, we're mainly talking about, well, I mean, we obviously do single gene testing, but we're talking about whole chromosomes. And I think one of the things, you know, that we think can happen is there's a lot of enzymes that have to activate. So even if you transfer an embryo that we know is genetically normal, we know it doesn't have any single gene abnormalities, there's lots of things that we don't understand. We don't understand what has to happen in the endometrium to make an embryo implant. There's probably a lot of genes that have to upregulate and downregulate as a pregnancy implants. And we don't understand a lot of those things. And I remember a few years ago at our fertility meeting that we go to, the American Society for Reproductive Medicine, there was a researcher on stage. She literally had spent her entire 20 plus year career trying to figure out what happens in the first 24 hours of life when the sperm and the egg go together. And she still had lots of things to learn. And so that really kind of brought it home to me that, you know, we really thought when we started doing PGT-A that was going to be the be all end all. And don't get me wrong, it's been great. Our fertility rates, pregnancy success has gone up dramatically. So it was a huge jump toward improving, you know, outcomes for patients. But I think what we've learned now that we're a few years into doing this pretty routinely is we still don't have all the answers. There's still a lot that we don't understand.
So another thing that comes to mind about kind of false reassurances, you know, that you can have if you do PGT-A is realize that not all birth defects are related to a gene or a chromosome that is identifiable. Okay. And you know, when people leave our care and they're going to the OB-GYN, they're sometimes like, oh, how much more of that, you know, OB-GYN testing do I need to do? Well, understand that, think of it like a heart defect. Okay. Although there are some chromosomal abnormalities that are linked to heart defects, most babies born with heart defects don't have one of those chromosomal abnormalities. And so, you know, organ system formation, heart formation, liver formation, the kidneys and the bladder, things that are absolutely essential to life, you know, those are things that perfect, you know, a chromosomally perfect embryo does not necessarily mean a completely physically normal child. And so that's,
you know, to that end, I remember an article probably about 3 or 4 years ago in our fertility and sterility journal that looked at babies that they knew were genetically normal that had been transferred from IVF. And the patients, I don't know, I can't remember the number of patients, one a huge number, but several of the patients knew that they had a fetal demise, meaning the baby did not have a heartbeat. It was not a viable pregnancy. And they consented to letting their doctor do hysteroscopy and look inside at the embryo to see if they could see any developmental issues. And I forgot a pretty good percentage of those, kind of to what you were just saying, morphologically didn't appear to be normal for the gestational age that they were. So it suggested that there was some sort of regulatory mechanism that didn't really work the way it was supposed to, and they were malformed, basically.
Mm-hmm. So sounds like the summary of all of this is that PGT is great, but it doesn't test for everything. And so one of the prime questions that I think all of us get at least half dozen times a week is, can you prevent autism? And a patients will come in having been very well read. Well, they've associated the genes that are associated with autism. I want you to test for these genes. And why is that not yet possible?
Well, I don't think anybody definitively knows what the genes are. I think there's a lot of different conditions that we know. And we know in our field, there's something called PGTP, which stands for polygenetic traits. And so those are traits, like Susan mentioned earlier, like heart disease and high blood pressure, and probably autism will fall into this as well, where there's not just one gene, like for example, eye color is the same thing. There's not just one gene that controls your eye color. And so, you know, researchers are trying to figure out what those genes are. I think no one's ready to kind of make the jump and say, oh yeah, these are the genes, so let's test embryos for this, because we just don't know yet.
I'd venture to also say there's something called methylation, where the in utero environment provides certain mechanisms that turn certain genes on and turn certain genes off. And there's probably a lot to do with, when we look at what we think potentially causes autism, methylation makes sense. In that, you know, we know that certain environments, like if you have very closely spaced pregnancies, that increases your risk of autism in that pregnancy. And so probably some of these things, you may have a gene, but it has to do with what's going on in your body and the experiences that little embryo is having on whether or not certain genes are going to get expressed. What do you think, Carrie?
I think that all makes a lot of logical sense, and it's methylation has a component to it of which light switches get flipped on and which ones stay off. There's also what else is present. You know, if you put a plant out in sunshine in an environment where it can get water versus you put that exact same plant in a dark room, you know, one of those plants is going to thrive and one of those plants isn't. And it has very little to do with the presence of the plant itself. It's related to the exact environment that it's in. And so
I like that.
There's so much that goes into this that just
nature or nurture, right?
You got it. It's not just the straight information that is being coded for. It's everything else that's happening around it. And so it's part of the reason why PGT is a phenomenal development. And when we look at it and we get the results that say normal versus abnormal, it's really helpful because it gives us a guide of what we're going to do and what we're not going to do. But even PGT doesn't always give straight normal and abnormal results. What is the third result that drives all of us and our patients totally batty when we see it?
Either no result or mosaicism.
Oh yes, mosaicism.
Yeah.
No result's pretty easy. No result just means we had as much information as we did beforehand versus in a lot of those situations, you can re-biopsy and get a result. But mosaicism is a little bit more complicated.
Mm-hmm. And we could probably spend an entire whole episode or four
on mosaicism itself. And so in order to not shortchange it, we're not going to dive in deep to that topic today. But mosaicism is it's a result that's kind of like, well, maybe.
I usually tell patients, it's like, if we look at 6 cells, maybe 4 of the cells say the embryo is completely normal, but 2 of them don't. And we don't know what to believe. We don't know what the baby is really going to become. If it really, you know, the part that's going to be the baby actually is going to be the normal cells or the abnormal cells. We don't know.
We are getting more information on that. But again, for another episode.
to be continued.
Mosaicism or the Yelp reviews, well, where you've got 5 stars from 4 of them and 1 star from the other 2. And which one do you believe?
All
right. Well, we will tie up this episode then so that we don't get mired in 1.5 million other discussions that will turn this into a 4-hour episode. But to our audience, thank you so much for listening. Be sure to tune in next week for more. Be sure to subscribe, leave us a review in Apple Podcasts. We would absolutely love to hear from you. We're on Instagram, we're on Facebook, and we're on YouTube. So stop by, leave us hello, a like, ask a question, tell us you like our hairdo, whatever. All right.
Maybe not today. You can also visit us on fertilitydocsuncensored.com to submit specific questions. All questions will be answered on our Ask the Doc segment. We love episode ideas. We'd love to hear from you. So give us your ideas and let us know what you want us to hear or say.
As always, this podcast is intended for entertainment and is not a substitute for medical advice from your own physician. All right. We'll talk to you soon. Bye.
Bye.
This podcast is also brought to you by Fertility Pharmacy of America. Fertility Pharmacy of America is a fertility-dedicated pharmacy that partners with physicians across the country in order to provide patients with a more personalized pharmacy experience. Pride ourselves on ensuring that every prescription is accurate, delivered in a timely manner, and most importantly, affordable for all patients. A team of trained pharmacists, technicians, and customer service representatives will be with you every step of the way, providing you with knowledge and exceptional quality care for all of your fertility medication needs. More than just a specialty pharmacy, they're a committed partner during your fertility journey. Fertility Pharmacy of America, making miracles happen every day. Please text or call us at 844-449-8767 and reference Fertility Docs Uncensored.